From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Patricia Arquette made heads turn and headlines Sunday night with an impassioned Oscar acceptance speech calling for equal pay for women. Women, she said, have fought for everybody else's equal rights. Now, she said, it's our time to have wage equality once and for all. She said more, too, and there's been a lot of dissection of her message, but the bottom line remains a very real pay gap. This hour On Point, gender equity, pay, and the Arquette message at the Oscars. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you see the pay gap, gender pay gap, in your workplace, in your family? In a time when women are told they can do anything, what do you think is behind it? Why is it still there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Actress Patricia Arquette won Best Supporting Actress for her role in the film Boyhood. She began going through the usual thank you center stage at the Oscars Sunday night.
Thank you to the Academy, to my beautiful, powerful nominees, to IFC, Jonathan Sarin, John Sloth, Kathleen Sutherland, Molly Madden, David DiCamillo, our whole cast and our crew.
And then she revved it up in a hurry with a message on gender pay equity.
To every woman who gave birth, to every taxpayer and citizen of this nation, we have fought for everybody else's equal rights. It's our time to have wage equality once and for all, and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
And Meryl Streep was on her feet right down front, and Jennifer Lopez right next to her, and a whole lot of big applause in the house. We're going to really get into this issue in this hour. Look at the numbers, where they stand, how they're moving, where they are moving, where they are not moving. I want to turn first to what's happening in Patricia Arquette's backyard, her own business, Hollywood. Melissa Silverstein joins me from New York, founder and editor of the online site Women and Hollywood, co-founder and artistic director of the Athena Film Festival, which just wrapped up in New York, focuses on women and leadership. Melissa, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Take us right to her home turf here in Hollywood. If there's a gender pay problem in this country, is it represented in Hollywood's pay system?
Absolutely. I think Hollywood is a representative of what's going on across this nation. I think that women are underpaid in Hollywood. There are a lack of opportunities for women to work in Hollywood at all levels, on screen and behind the scenes, and that's reflected in how women get paid.
I'm looking here at a report that says the 10 highest paid actors from 2013 made $465 million, the top 10. The top 10 highest paid actresses, women, $181 million. That is a fraction of what the guys made. What is that about? Why does it end up that way?
Well, it ends up that way for a variety of reasons. The big budget movies are superhero and action films, and those mostly star men. And so they get the big dollars up front, and that's how that figures into it. Robert Downey Jr. has been one of the top grossing actors for the last several years, and pretty much all on the back of Iron Man movies and Avenger-type movies.
And women don't typically star in those. You had in 2013, Angelina Jolie, top paid actress, $33 million her income. That put her down at, she was number one for women. Among men, that put her down with number 9 and 10, Liam Neeson and Denzel Washington. Looking at last year here, numbers just out on, Sandra Bullock, $51 million, highest earning actress last year. So more than Jolie, but still this big gap is there. Is Patricia Arquette known in Hollywood as a crusader, a campaigner on this issue, Melissa?
Well, I've spoken with Patricia Arquette, interviewed her, and she was really down to earth and spoke also in several interviews about how she paid her babysitter and her dog walker more than she made on Boyhood. So clearly she's becoming engaged in these issues, if she hasn't been for some time, and wanted to spur a conversation about this issue that could resonate beyond Hollywood. And that's what the Academy Awards has the opportunity to do. We've been having a conversation, the good and the bad, in what she had in her speech for the last 2 days nonstop. And really, it's about the lack of opportunities for women in Hollywood. Patricia Arquette's been working has had a very long career. She's actually going back to television. She's going to star in CSI Cyber, which starts airing really shortly. And that's just what's happening to women, is that the opportunities for them are on the small screen, not on the big screen.
We had the Hollywood hack that brought a bunch of numbers out recently that showed that in the movie with Bradley Cooper, and Amy Adams and Christian Bale and
American Hustle,
Jennifer Lawrence. So suddenly the emails are out, and we saw there that the women who starred in that movie made less than their male counterparts. That was not a superhero movie, so why in that case?
Well, I think this is just how Hollywood looks at women, is that they see longevity in male careers and they don't really see that in women's careers. And what Amy Pascal, who actually was the head of Sony and now has been forced out of Sony, said in a recent speech was that it's not her job to push for pay equity. It's the job of the people who represent these women. And so they need to ask for more. And I think there is a problem with the fact that there are not enough roles for women. And so people want to work. So we need to pay women what they're worth. I think Jennifer Lawrence right now, if we had a conversation about her making American Hustle now, she wouldn't be on the back end of any problems now, as she's been, you know, the top grossing film for the last 2 years. But one more point about this Sony hack was that 16 of the 17 top paid people at Sony who made $1 million or more were men. And now with Amy Pascal being forced out and Tom Rothman taking over her job, now it's 17 of 17. So not only do we have a wage gap in Hollywood, we have a power gap. And that's something I hope people will talk about further.
Melissa Silverstein with Women and Hollywood, founder and editor of the online site. Melissa, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Arquette had more to say at the Oscars, not from center stage, but backstage, stirred a little controversy with these remarks, talking about who's fought for whom, equal rights, and who ought to be fighting for her now.
Even though we sort of feel like we have equal rights in America, right under the surface, there are huge issues that are at play that really do affect women. And it's time for all the women in America and all the men that love women and all the gay people and all the people of color that we've all fought for to fight for us now.
There's money in there. There's politics in there. There's a lot packed in right there. There's been a lot of dissection of it in the days since the Oscars. But we're starting just with the big picture here. Heidi Hartman joins me right now. She's president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, professor at George Washington University, author of Still a Man's Labor Market, The Long-Term Earnings Gap. Heidi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. It's my pleasure.
Can you help us just with the big numbers here? We have heard thrown around on Oscar night and otherwise 77 cents on the dollar, 78 cents on the dollar, women compared to men. But then I'm reading here in the Wall Street Journal, it says women make 82 cents for every dollar a man makes, according to the most recent figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And then you get other people who say these are all apples and oranges comparisons anyway, and they don't really make sense. What is the reality, Heidi?
Okay, that is a big debate, and you're absolutely right that actually our government puts out two numbers. One is the 78% pay ratio in 2013 for annual full-time earnings, both men and women who work year-round full-time, all different jobs. But when you compare their full-time earnings, the women are only making 78% of the men. Most economists, like myself, we like to use that number because it's been around longer historically, and it includes the self-employed, which the other number does not. Then we have another number that comes from the government, the 82% you mentioned. That's median weekly earnings. So that's what you earn per week working full-time. But it does compare men and women who don't necessarily work every week because it'll just compare you in the week you work full-time. And it does not include the self-employed. But they're both there. The significant thing about both of those series, they're long-term, is that they do show the wage gap narrowing. It used to be 60% with a wage gap of 40%, pay ratio of 60%, wage gap of 40%. So, hey, now we're down to 23%, 18%, somewhere in there. That's progress. But the problem is that that progress has been very, very slow for like the last 10 to 15 years, depending on which series you're looking at. So for a very long time, there hasn't been any further closure of the gap. And that's what I think is upsetting women in particular, but you know, also puzzling economists, and why that long-term progress that we had has suddenly stopped. You also asked about, you know, is it really right? Is the pay gap really small? Well, if you narrow it to particular occupations, let's say we look only at grade school teachers, that's a much narrower wage gap. Those people are generally public servants. They're often represented by unions. They will try to equalize the pay between men and women. And it will be more equal also partly because we all have that information available. Public servants usually have their salaries public. You can learn what they are, unlike in the private sector. But there are many other single occupations you could look at, like financial manager, where the wage gap is much bigger. So I think it makes sense to look at that average wage gap for the economy as a whole, the whole labor force, everybody working full-time year-round, no matter what they do. I mean, when you think about it, if you thought it was right that women should make more than less than men, you're kind of saying, hey, when they both put in the same effort year-round, I think the women are, you know, less capable, or that's why it's okay they get less. So when people challenge that labor force-wide number, that economy-wide number, I'm always wondering, you know, what they're really thinking about women's capabilities.
I mean, I don't know who would argue that it's okay for them to make less for equal work. People get into big debates about what is equal work. If, you know, someone's mm-hmm. in a very high-paying field and someone else is in a very low-paying field, you're going to have a gap, whether you're a man and woman or I mean, two men at different jobs will have very different incomes, obviously. And
right,
that gets
but on average, excuse me, I was just going to say, you would think they both have the similar skills and talents.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about what women earn and actress Patricia Arquette's big call for equal pay at the Oscars. Everybody who watched heard it, saw it. You could not miss it. It was very impassioned. There was a huge response from the hall that night, and there's been a lot of talk in the days since about this. One woman was listening, Hillary Clinton. She spoke at the Watermark Silicon Valley Conference for Women in Santa Clara, California, yesterday about equal pay for women.
Many women are paid less for the same work, which is why I think we all cheered at Patricia Arquette's speech at the Oscars, because she's right. It's time to have wage equality once and for all.
We've got Heidi Hartman with us. She's president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. It's a group that looks at women's economics, public policy, professor at George Washington University, joining us from Washington today. With us as well now from Ithaca, New York, is Beth Livingston, professor of Human Resources Studies at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. Beth Livingston, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
What do you see going on in these numbers, this persistent gap? It was closing for years. Lately, Heidi says, is not closing so much. Is this, first of all, is it real? Is Hillary Clinton right? Barack Obama used the same phrase earlier, paid less for the same work. Is that true? And second, what's driving? Is it discrimination? Is it women's choices? Is it wrong even to ask that?
No, I don't think it's wrong to ask that. I think, you know, Professor Hartman made some really great points about, you know, how economists really break down the gender wage gap and look and control within occupation and for how many hours people have worked and fertility in terms of how long people have been out of the labor force. Great economists have been doing this work on the gender wage gap for decades and have found consistently that even though it's not necessarily as large as just looking at weekly wages or median weekly wages versus median weekly wages for men and women, once you start breaking down the causes of it, there still are quite large unexplained components of it, and it has stagnated over time. And that's something, I'm a psychologist and coming from a more interpersonal and individual background and studying family and work choices, I think is very interesting because although we have seen this narrowing in the gender wage gap and a lot of explanation and discussion about why it might have stagnated, I like to look at the individual components of that and how our family structure and the way we manage family and our choices surrounding that and our gendered norms and expectations might affect what we get paid.
I mean, if you begin to break it down in that way, it is interesting. The gap never really goes away, though. I'm looking here at statistics that show what? For women aged 25 to 34, that the median weekly earnings as a percentage of men's were 90%, much closer than 78%. For women never married, 96%. Now, married, a married parent, you get down to 76%. How do you explain that, Beth?
Well, I think we've seen, you know, the workplace is, I mean, we have made a lot of progress, and the workplace has become more egalitarian over time. We've had great legislative policies and also great HR from some of our wonderfully large companies who have put in great policies to promote equity. But we haven't seen a lot of that happen on the home front. We still have a lot of gendered norms about what mothers are and what sort of work they're expected to do, who fathers are and what sort of work they're expected to do, and what it actually means to have a free choice to do that. You know, in terms of when people take leave, who is responsible for taking care of children, even if you have a dual career couple who husband and wife both work full time, there still often is a differentiation in who's spending more time taking care of the household duties. And society knows that, and people know that individually as well.
Let's go to Tariq, calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Tariq, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I don't disagree necessarily with the idea of equal pay for equal work. You know what I'm saying? I have no disagreement with that. But Patricia Arquette, the only reason I had with was the fact that she was saying, you know, it's time for minorities, you know, and gays to support them. And I was kind of, and for me as a black man in America, you know, I was out of work for a year with a college degree and a year's experience, I was like, I mean, there's a big gap for minorities in terms of white women and white men, too. I mean, I don't feel like, and I know the history of feminism, I know it wasn't always necessarily the black community and our needs weren't necessarily supported by them.
So when you see a white actress in a designer gown standing with a golden statue in her hand saying it's time for you to fight for her, what, you're still not entirely sure?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I see her. I'm not saying she shouldn't get equal pay, but even if it's the millions of dollars, hey, get it if you can. But for me, I'm not getting equal pay for a lot of my own counterparts for the same job, and it's harder for me to find a job. I have to lie and say I have to put different names.
Yeah.
I have to, you know, I've had jobs where I've applied, and when I put a black, I don't get a call back until I put I'm white, you know. So for me to say that for her, you know, support her, great, but don't act like we've never supported her and that you have it harder necessarily. You know, I just thought it was pretentious. It was a slap in the face, I felt like.
Pretentious, slap in the face. Tariq, I appreciate your call. Heidi Hartman, what about this angle? There's been a long-running debate in the turf of feminism about who it's really for. There were complaints back in the day that it was for white women. Tariq hears a slap in the face when she asks gays and people of color to rally to her cause, this cause now. Do you understand that sentiment, Heidi?
Oh, absolutely. I understand both Patricia's and Tariq's sentiment. I think Patricia's reacting to the fact that we know from research that almost every social movement, women are the majority of the activists. They're the majority of the ones who contribute funds and can contribute time, whether you're looking at civil rights or environmental or whatever. So she's probably reacting to that and the idea that, you know, women are taught, you know, that's part of their image is that they're sacrificing for others. And she's saying, hey, enough of that. And we've done a lot for other people and we want you other people to help us. So I'm sympathetic with that. I'm also sympathetic with Tariq. I mean, black men in America make about the same on average as white women. They don't get the advantage of male, you know, discrimination in favor of males because they're suffering from discrimination against blacks. So he's got a great point. He doesn't have equal pay either. And he's not so sure that people like Patricia have really come to his defense that often.
Of course, it's certainly not just an issue of white women. In fact, if you look across color lines here, women's earnings ratio by race when compared to white men, you've got white women 78% non-Hispanic, but Hispanic or Latina women 54%, Native American 59%, African American women compared to white men 64%. I mean, they've got more to complain about than anybody here, Beth.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, there absolutely is a gender wage gap and an issue that we need to talk about, but the intersectionality between gender, race, class, ethnicity, all of those issues and how they intersect with one another is something that we often don't talk a lot about because it's hard to have organizations that are dedicated to that. And historically, you know, people of color, women of color have been left out of, you know, the suffrage the suffragette movement. And historically, there have been those sort of battle lines drawn. And it's unfortunate because, you know, there really are quite a few people suffering from unfair biases. And I can definitely see where Tariq is coming from and all of the many conversations I've seen happening on Twitter and elsewhere throughout this whole weekend about who's been left out of the conversation and the fact that it's not black versus white women or men versus women, that, you know, sometimes there are black women and Native American women and Hispanic women, and all of these things intersect with one another, and you start to get into a lot of differences that occur. So I think there's a great point there to be had as well.
Let's get a call from Brooklyn. Winter is calling. Hi, Winter. Great to have you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah.
I was basically going to bring up intersectionality and this idea that to get upset at what Patricia Arquette said and to look at it divisively in the larger picture, which, and this was a model of the civil rights movement, you know, lifting as we climb, this notion that we don't have an ESA and we should. It shouldn't have failed. What we all need to do is be standing up for people who are marginalized, regardless of what race we are or what our sexuality is or what our gender is. You know, as someone who's gay, I'm standing up for women's rights. I'm standing up for gay rights. I'm standing up for trans rights. I'm standing up for the rights of people of color.
Yep.
Because it's no one wants to be oppressed, and no one wants, I don't know if other people want to oppress others, but the goal is us all.
Winter, you're breaking up, but I'm glad for your call saying don't put the divisions out front here. There's a lot to work on collectively, and that is seen right across the country. Here was a little bit from Sheryl Sandberg last year. She was talking with the Huffington Post about the gender pay gap and some of the numbers behind it.
If you equalize for hours worked and years worked, you get to 81 cents. If you equalize for occupational differences, even though I and others would argue there is definitely gender playing into occupational differences, you get to 91 cents. So it's indisputable that there's a real pay gap. People can argue about how big, but that's almost besides the point. The point is that every woman, every girl deserves to get paid what they're worth.
Hard to argue with that. Heidi Hartman, when Barack Obama, when he was campaigning, or Hillary Clinton just yesterday in Silicon Valley, says many women are paid less for the same work, is that factually the case, Heidi?
Yes and no. We have looked at all those 500 or so occupations that the Census Bureau measures, and in virtually all of them, there's sometimes three or four in which women out-earn men. But in virtually every single occupation, men out-earn women. So typically we think of the occupation as the same work. You're a school teacher, you're a radio announcer, whatever. So it is true that women don't get equal pay for the same work. I mean, there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of cases really thousands, which women have won within a workplace, showing that they didn't have equal pay, and that's very typically very identical jobs where that finding comes from. So we know there are many cases in the real world where women do not get equal pay for the same work. But I will say that gender wage ratio of 78% that we were talking about, and that 22% pay gap, that is for different jobs. So Barack Obama, when he was campaigning, he typically said it correctly. He would say men and women deserve equal pay for an equal day's work. So they both worked full-time, year-round. They deserve equal pay. Hillary Clinton, in that clip you had, she narrowed it to equal pay in the same job, which actually is what Bill Clinton did when he was president. He always said that 78% figure was equal pay in the same job. And I felt like every time I heard it, I cringed, and I wanted to, you know, call the White House right away.
Not quite true, that. Beth Livingston, it's interesting to hear where you're coming from on this. I mean, family dynamics do intersect with work dynamics here, and you've thought about and talked about some of the choices that women make in terms of the kind of jobs they go for, in terms of what they push for, in terms of accommodation and income.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we often talk about choice. And when you hear people dissect the gender wage gap, and even, for instance, on your website, and I'm watching the conversations go on there, and I'm seeing people say, well, you know, either it's discrimination or it's free choice that women have chosen jobs that tend to pay less because they have family responsibilities or they choose to have more children. You see this a lot of talk about choice. What we don't talk a lot about is how those choices and family responsibilities are constrained by the same gender norms. norms that can lead to a gender wage gap. That we all have ideas in our mind of what a mother means and what children require and what it means to be a woman keeping house. I mean, you have all of these stereotypes that have lasted for many, many years. And I think it's one reason why that gender wage gap has stagnated over time is that there has to be time. Legislation can go so far, but cultural change and attitudinal change of what it means to share the work of the family, I think that takes a lot longer to come about.
So what does that leave you thinking about pay, that women, they're putting more into the family because within their marriage they're expected to do that? Is this the fault or the problem of the employer? Can we come up with a formula that brings justice here across all these subtle lines?
I think fault is a very interesting conversation to have, because I think there's a little bit of, you know, it doesn't just because the employer isn't that individual who's fighting for gender wage gap, they still have their own gendered attitudes, and it can manifest itself in things like, I know she just had a baby, I don't want to put this project on her right now because I know she's got a lot on her mind, and then that project goes to somebody else who then, you know, can make more money and get more power. There are subtle things that happen in the dynamics of family and work, assumptions that we make about what pregnant women or mothers can or don't want to handle. And it doesn't have to be nefarious to a point of women can't do this or mothers don't do that. Oftentimes, it's actually meant to be supportive, but it can backfire in that you lose out on job opportunities, the ability to move up in an organization. You get pushed into a support staff instead of a line occupation where you can move up the ladder. And oftentimes, that also manifests itself in how people interact with their spouse at home, and that we know that men are often culturally pushed to be the man, right? To make money, to support their families. We hear that a lot. And it's very hard, I think, sometimes for women to tell their husbands, even if their husbands would be very supportive of that, to say, you know what? I got this great opportunity. We're moving across the country because my job is important. And those sort of interactions at the home level, I think, are very interesting.
Heidi Hartman, does the fact of motherhood for so many women mean that getting, you know, to a one-to-one ratio, male-to-female compensation, is just not likely to show up on the books?
Well, I'm certainly hoping it will show up on the books someday. We did a projection at my think tank, the Institute for Women's Policy Research, that we should have pay equity by 2058 if we make progress.
I would love to know how you calculate that. That's fascinating. I mean, what human nature or social campaign is going to produce it on that particular date?
Well, we calculated it statistically. We just said, hey, if the rate of progress we've had, even with the slowdown, but going all the way back to 1960, that rate of progress carried forward in a straight line would get us to 2058. Of course, no one knows whether we'll carry forward in a straight line.
It's a long
line
time, but at least it's some time. At least it's not never.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think that the issues Beth is talking about are very, very valid. But when we actually do time use studies on the job, we find that women work more per hour on the job than men do. They actually spend less time on the phone, taking care of personal business, chatting with each other.
Huh. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about what women earn. And actress Patricia Arquette's big call for equal pay from center stage at the Oscars on Sunday night. Heidi Hartman is with us from the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington. Beth Livingston's here from Ithaca, New York, and Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. All kinds of views on this. There was the interesting leak that came out about pay differentials in the movie business when Paramount got hacked by North Korea or whoever did that when all that came out. Just a couple of weeks ago in San Francisco, the woman who was head of the Sony studios at the time, Amy Pascal, talked with Tina Brown at the Woman in the World conference about negotiation, intensity maybe. Here's Pascal and then Brown.
People want to work for less money. I'll pay them less money. I don't call them up and go, can I give you some more? Because that's not what you do when you run a business. The truth is that what women have to do is not work for less money. They have to walk away. People shouldn't be so grateful for jobs. I shouldn't be grateful. And if you should be grateful, they shouldn't be grateful. People should know what they're worth and say no. And they will.
That's great.
You've got to be tough, says Amy Pascal. They're talking with Tina Brown, who says, that's great. Joyce in Augusta, Georgia. Joyce, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, we've run into that very same issue in my family. I have a daughter out there in Hollywood who is an editor, behind-the-scenes technological stuff.
Yeah.
And the first thing she discovered when she went out there is there were almost no females in mentoring positions, no one networking with the women. Everybody in the entertainment industry goes from job to job.
Mm-hmm.
It's from project to project.
Right.
And the way you get your jobs and go to these projects is by networking. And when there's almost no women in the network and in the mentoring field, it was very difficult for her. Another issue was she had to learn how to negotiate a contract going from project to project, which is not something as a girl she had been brought up to even think about. All those issues about what she's worth, what are the other people she works with getting? It was hard to find out what the guys were getting.
Yeah, Joyce, that's a great report right from the battlefront there. Beth, if I may bring those two things to you, one, mentoring, and two, negotiation. What about mentoring and males kind of handing on awareness, insight, access, maybe jobs themselves? How big a factor might that be in the pay gap? And then what about negotiation styles? What do we know about that?
We actually know quite a bit about both of those topics, which I think is really interesting. So Joyce makes a really great point about networking and mentoring and getting good jobs and moving along in the career path and getting an opportunity to even negotiate for more money is, you know, really predicated on the idea that we have those opportunities to get by and we have something that makes us stand out. And, you know, we know from network research that people tend to that idea of birds of a feather flock together. That's actually a fairly true psychological statement. And that most of the time, people tend to like people who are like them, and they understand them, they feel comfortable around them, and those things tend to continue to build on each other over time. It's hard for outsiders to break into those sort of networks. And also with mentoring, what we see is informal mentoring situations, oftentimes they'll try to assign women to younger women, when often what actually gets younger women or younger people or women of color in organizations ahead in organizations is having a powerful mentor. And oftentimes the most powerful mentors are also men, and they don't tend to choose to mentor younger women as often as they choose to mentor younger men. So there is a differentiation in that. When it comes to negotiation, what's fascinating is we have been for years, really, there's been some great work looking at that question of women don't ask. Well, women would be paid more if they asked for it. And it's a fascinating idea because it is true. There are differences in gender differences in that women don't start negotiations the same way men do, and they don't negotiate in the same ways. But interesting research has emerged to show that when they do, when women do act as a man does, let's say.
And what does that mean, to start a negotiation?
Well, instead of just accepting what someone gives you, to actually initiate a negotiation over something, to say, okay, you know what, I'm actually going to begin the negotiation. Because oftentimes they don't, your boss isn't going to say, would you like to negotiate that with me? They don't actually give you an opening. You actually have to initiate that and start that process. And women don't tend to do that as much as men do. But at the same time, when women do act in those sort of competitive, you know, dominant sort of ways, they can really, what's kind of strange about it is they can experience a backlash because they're not acting the way women typically act, and then they can be seen as, you know, the big B word and all of those sorts of issues.
You mean when they try to become tough negotiators, they're penalized for that?
They absolutely can be penalized for that. Absolutely. So it's a double-edged sword. It helps, but there are still issues that make it not as effective to say, if you want to get ahead, women, just act like men. It's helped us get somewhere, but it isn't always closing the gap completely.
I mean, we heard Amy Pascal there, Heidi Hartman, saying, if you want more, you'd better ask for it. The employer is not just going to give it to you. Heidi, let me put this to you. This is from a listener, Jules. Says, in order to be successful in this society, you have to have a hard heart. You have to be willing to take advantage of, even hurt other people. This is Jules' view. You have to have a lack of empathy. Since women are socialized to be empathetic and men are socialized to shut out their feelings, many women are not willing to do the kinds of things you have to do to be successful, but many men are. Well, how do you respond to that, Heidi?
Well, I think, unfortunately, he's put his finger on something. that is a bit true, and I think what Professor Livingston was talking about illustrates it, that when the woman acts like a man and is tough, she is penalized for it. We have many examples of that. I thought Melissa Silverman earlier in your show made a good point about the structure in Hollywood. It's hard to be a tough negotiator if you're not in demand. If there are not enough jobs for women in Hollywood, you can't be as tough a negotiator as a guy.
And only 12% of lead roles there are going to women.
Right. And what about women of all ages? I mean, that point also that she made, that the studios want to invest in a brand name that's going to be last for them for 50 years. Well, that's going to be a guy. There are very few Meryl Streeps in the world who have been able to blossom and bloom over her entire career. That's a factor, these structural things. And, you know, I think what Professor Livingston was getting at is that it's almost a structural thing that people react to women who go out of their role to be more like men. They have a structural reaction to that. Whoops, that's not right. She's not doing the right thing. I would like to think that we can have a more humane system. I think one of the, you know, so we don't all have to be mean and bloodthirsty and cruel to each other. Mm. And I think that if we had more public policies that were like that, that would be helpful in changing people's attitudes in the work world. We're one of the few countries that does not guarantee people paid sick days. So you have to choose if you're a mom or a dad and between your job and staying home with your sick kid. And if you're sick without children, you have to choose between your job and taking care of your own illness. That doesn't happen in other countries. We don't have required paid family leave in very many places. We have 3 states now that do offer it, but nowhere else in America. So I think when the public policies are a little bit more humane, I'm hoping that, you know, that will change all of our attitudes and change business attitudes as well, to think that, you know what, really, we can get ahead in this particular business better. We can be more profitable if we treat our workers well, if we treat each other well, we treat our customers well. I mean, I think there's some gains to be made from having a more, you know, humane style of business and economic system.
Make that part of the structure, too. Dee in Augusta, Georgia. Dee, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I am currently in a situation where I am negotiating salary. Well, actually, I've negotiated 3 times with the VA here in Augusta, Georgia. I'm a physician assistant, and originally the pay that they offered for what I do with 3 years' experience as a physician assistant, if I was brand new, I wouldn't have even been offered as little as what they're offering or what they offered me. I was actually made to feel like there was no way to negotiate, but I knew that there was. I had read. And even with the pay that I had to finally settle on, it is below the national average, and that could be because we're in the South. But my pay went before a board, and the head of that board is female. And she actually told the person who is hiring me that she went up as high as she can go because my pay was only 10% less than what she was making, and this is a board of physician assistants. Another aspect to this is, as a physician assistant, we are called mid-level providers. Well, also nurse practitioners are mid-level providers. Well, nurse practitioners actually get paid less overall for the exact same work that physician assistants do because nurse practitioners are a female-dominated field. However, over the years now, physician assistants have become a more female-dominated field, and our pay has not gone up in trajectory that you would expect. It has actually leveled off. So if there's any men out there, I really wish they would get back into the field.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, Dee. Let me pick it up there. Our time grows short, but Heidi, the possibility of a whole category of work being less well compensated as it comes to be more dominated by women?
Yes, that's a real phenomenon in the labor market. We see it everywhere. Also, when jobs are dominated by minorities, whether male or female, they tend to pay less as well. And there have been some actual studies of this, of looking at when specific jobs changed and seeing that it's not just that the nature of the job changes or there's more technology, so a less skilled person can do it. I mean, those are plausible explanations for that, but it does really seem to be connected to the people who do the job, which you can understand if we have attitudes, biased attitudes, discriminatory attitudes that these people are not as competent. They don't work as hard. They don't do as well. We're going to pay them less. So, yes, it does happen. And another thing to look at is she mentioned nurse practitioners. That's one of the best paid female-dominated jobs actually in the whole labor market. But all those low-paid jobs, home health aides, child care worker, nursing psychiatric aide, maid and household cleaner, cashier, a lot of those are female-dominated. There's just a concentration of minority women and white women in these very low-paid jobs at the bottom. When you look at the least skilled jobs for men, laborer, they do not pay as little as the least paid jobs for women. So even at the bottom, men are getting paid slightly more. But absolutely, the differences among women and men by race and ethnicity are very important and very dispiriting, really. It's depressing when you look over our economy and see how people are slotted and how their opportunities for moving forward are restricted.
Peter's calling from Boston. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom, long-time listener, and condolences on your wife. Listen, I happen to have been in the military, and I've been an attorney for 40-plus years, representing women, working class, and affluent women. There's lies, damn lies, and statistics. And here's my question. The military, everybody in the military starts at E1. It's probably one of the biggest employees in the United States. Every E1 up to general, if they're a female or male, get the same pay. Postal workers, everybody in the federal government, they get the same pay by pay grades. Everybody in county, police, I represent police, if they're all getting the same pay. So I always try to figure out, where is this big discrepancy? And then it comes in construction, in the union in Massachusetts. Union workers, laborers, the ones who work in the office get the same pay as the guys who are digging the ditches. I've represented them. What I'm concerned with is how they get this pay gap. And I look at this Roseanne Arquette. I mean, I think she's upset that she's not making the money that Tom Cruise is. And it seems to me it's always college professors, women back on the career track that took time off to raise children, coming back in. They're the ones who push this. They're not getting equal pay.
Peter, our time is short. Let me pick it up. Patricia Arquette, of course. But Beth, what do you say? Peter, you know, he looks at a lot of government jobs there and sees a lot of equality by structure, by design, and he's just not buying it. That's skepticism. What do you say, Beth?
Well, I understand skepticism, particularly when you're dealing with individual issues. There are absolutely individual issues, as Heidi has pointed out, where women do make more of the same money as men. And when you're a lawyer and you're representing individuals, that makes sense that you would see those stories that come out. But I think that when you talk about statistics and you see the gender wage gap and you look at that the people who have controlled for hours worked and the type of occupation and the type of work that's doing and how many children you have, and you see the gender wage gap consistently emerging, economists from everywhere finding these sort of things, that you can say, okay, maybe statistics can be moved around for different people's agendas, but these sort of things emerging consistently using different data sets over time, it's a lot harder to explain away. And it's more likely that those specific individual experiences are occupation specific or individual specific as opposed to recognizing some sort of larger trend.
Beth, Heidi talked a little bit about public policies tips that might be taken. What about individual attitudes or strategies that you find may help women climb up through this thicket?
Well, as someone who is really interested in how work and family intersect and how that can affect what we do at work, I think it's often important to have the conversation about what people's expectations are with their partners about work and family in terms of what sort of load do you expect me to carry? Whose career in this household is primary? Does it matter how much money we make? Are we sacrificing for your career or for mine? When does that change? Does it ever change? Those sort of communication patterns and discussions that people have with one another, I think, can have a really big impact on the sorts of career decisions that people make and release those choices. We talk about people having the freedom to make those choices. Having those conversations behind the scenes can help free up those choices to be made in the workplace.
Heidi, we've just got half a minute here. Equal pay by 2058 is your projection. What's it going to take to make that happen other than just time?
Well, I think a lot of public policy change along the lines that I mentioned before, plus cultural change, like Professor Livingston is talking about. Young people, when they form a relationship, asking about who's going to do what, that's very important. But also in enforcing our anti-discrimination laws, continuing to move women into higher education, and especially in the best-paid jobs, science, technology, engineering, those would be great fields for more women to move into.
There's the path. 2058 can sound like a long time away.
Maybe we can do it a little more briskly than that. I'm grateful to each of you for being with us today. Heidi Hartman at the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington. Ms. Hartman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Professor Beth Livingston at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Thank you, Professor Livingston, for being here.
Thanks for the invitation.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for being with us today. This is On Point.